What's the most novel tie you have?
Anything
that lights up, that moves?
You know,
those bow ties that spins around,
squirts water.
You know, I have a few that used to be light up Christmas ties, but I took the lights out of them because then you also have to have batteries. Yeah. That's just going too far.
Yeah, it's the potential of catching on fire is high.
Well, exactly.
There,
right? I mean,
electricity around your neck is bad.
I know. There's something very strange about ties to begin with, but then to electrify them. I've got some great Christmas ties, those are pretty good. Spider-Man, I have a lot of Disney ties, Mickey Mouse, Jungle Book, Donald Duck. My very angry Donald Duck tie, I would sometimes...
Finals week.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I've got a grumpy Donald Duck tie, like for when I'm reviewing proposals or reading student essays.
That's magnificent.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You do kind of pair them, right, with the day. I remember this from Fuller. You, at least then you attempted.
If like there is some kind of tie-in that I can make.
All right.
Welcome to Forward, a TED's faculty podcast. I'm James Arcadi.
And I'm Felipe Dovale.
Today, we have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Justin Barrett with us today. He's a psychologist and also is president and co-founder of Blueprint 1543, which is an organization that is attempting to integrate Christian theology and the sciences to answer life's biggest questions, as I understand it, which is a great and cool and exciting thing. He's also an honorary professor of theology and the sciences at St. Andrews University. And prior to these endeavors, he was at Fuller Seminary, and we overlapped with one another there. Justin was there for much longer than I was. I was only there for about 3 years or so. But he was a professor of psychology as well as the Thrive Professor of Developmental Science at Fuller Theological Seminary in Southern California. It's a great place. But before that, also, he had served at Calvin College, Calvin University, as well as University of Oxford. And we're delighted to have you with us today, Justin.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And so Justin has also just recently given a lecture at the Henry Center, and it was fantastic. And some of the things we're going to cover today, he spoke about, and he also spoke about in his book, Thriving with Stone Age Minds. We're also going to get into that. But first, Justin, what we'd love to hear about is your journey into where you've been or you've gotten to now. It sounds like you've had a fairly interesting academic career. You know, you've been in multiple different countries and states. Could you give us a little picture of how you got to be where you are today? What motivated
you? Wish I knew.
I mean, how did you get interested in psychology, and how did you, you know, yeah, any direction you'd like to take that?
Sure. Well, growing up, I was sort of a science-y kid. I loved the outdoors. I loved nature. I was fascinated by especially biological systems. I remember having one of these moments in, like, you know, junior year of high school of just staring at my hand and marveling at the complexity of this thing that was on my body, right? And I thought that... after I shook off the idea of being an overseas missionary, I thought, you know, I want to study biology and, you know, go into the sciences. So I went to Calvin College as an undergraduate and started the pre-med sequence, but then had to take some, you know, core course, as they called it, in psychology or sociology. I picked psychology. And until that moment taking that class, I did not realize that there was this science of psychology. And one of the things that attracted me to biology was just the complexity and wonder of the natural world. But then here's an organism or a thing that's even more complex because it's at once biological, but then something else. It's psychological, it's social, and that's the human mind. And the idea that I could actually do science on this just captivated me. So I got excited about that. I changed majors. I did all of that. Eventually decided I you know, go to grad school and become an academic. That felt like the direction that God was calling me to do. So I started looking at research projects and things. And one, I was fascinated by psychology of religion. You know, I grew up in a faith family, and I knew how important thinking about God is, what an important role God had played in my life, in the lives of people around me, what the importance of religious experiences for people, and so forth. And so I started reading as an undergraduate in psychology of religion, and I just wanted to know more about God concepts and get into that area of study. But I had this weird idea that to study concepts, which is a cognitive construct, I should go into cognitive psychology. But cognitive psychologists weren't studying God concepts at that time. Social psychologists were, to a certain extent, and personality and clinical psychologists, but not cognitive psychologists. So I tried to study from a cognitive psychology perspective, God concepts, and I didn't really find anybody who was enthusiastic about that, but I did get into a graduate program with a guy that humored me. Frank Kyle was my doctoral advisor, and he admitted to me when I was finishing that he accepted me to work for him because he thought my project would fail and he could put me on something else, which was very generous of him. Yeah, well, it's kind of a backhanded compliment, but yeah. I'll take it because it was sincere. What he was trying to say was, wow, you know, I really wasn't hopeful that there was something interesting here, but you proved me wrong. Mm. And it was really fun working on this. And so he helped me connect with some other folks who were starting to use these cognitive science-y approaches to study of religion. So I got to be on the ground floor of what has now become known as cognitive science of religion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But all these other people, they were from outside of psychology. They're anthropologists, religious studies scholars, and mm-hmm. so forth. I was the scientist. And we just figured out this field together mm-hmm. and what the initial studies would look like. And so that's kind of how I got into the yeah. subject matter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that makes everything sound a lot more linear than it turned out to
sure,
be.
Because sure.
I taught at Calvin for a while. Yeah. I went from there to University of Michigan. And then I left the academy.
Okay.
I became a little disillusioned with higher ed. I didn't like how students were being treated in some ways mm-hmm. that I'd seen that it was a little too economic a system. Mm-hmm. Okay, we need students to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm. And,
I didn't like that we seemed to be doing a lot of writing grants to pay the bills and not to answer big questions. Mm-hmm. So it was, how can we sort of contort ourselves a bit to get the money? And so it just didn't feel good to me. Mm-hmm. Right around that time, 9/11 happened, which mm-hmm. for a lot of us was a kind of a gut check. You know, are you on the right path? Are you doing something that mm-hmm. matters?
Mm-hmm.
And so my wife and I started talking about that. And, you know, we decided it was time for her to get back into the job force. And she applied for and got a position working at one of Young Life's properties, Rockbridge Alum Springs. And so I resigned my post at Michigan and we moved to rural Virginia.
Mm.
And I was a stay-at-home dad. Homeschooled my kids and volunteered out at the Young Life camp.
Yeah.
Wow.
We did that for about 3 years and then shifted from that to Young Life field staff, mm-hmm. where we did direct ministry in Lawrence, Kansas, supervised a bunch of volunteers and did the Young Life thing,
yeah.
which was great. But in hindsight, it's easy to see that I was still, I think, shaking off my evangelical heritage that said the best thing you can do with your life is go into professional ministry and mm. anything else is sort of lesser than, which is a message we unfortunately give our young people pretty quickly through the churches and stuff, right?
Because yeah.
who do we introduce as, oh, this fantastic inspirational guest speaker, a missionary or a pastor or,
mm-hmm.
and when people are sharing their testimony, oh, this is Elder so-and-so, and here's how he went from, you know, a street person to an elder. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's all about the church life, churchy kinds of categories.
Yeah.
And so it's been a struggle to shake that off and realize that my calling could be as a nerd, really, as an academic,
yeah,
working on ideas, yeah, and things like that. So yeah, did the Young Life thing. Strangely got asked at one point, at the same time that, for various reasons, we were needing to leave that position. Actually, it was 1 week after hearing that we were done with Young Life in that area. Nobody knew, but I got a colleague who I'd known for a while, had just been appointed the new head of the School of Anthropology at Oxford okay. University. And he reached out and said, you know, he didn't know that I was essentially out of a job at that point. And he asked if I could come to Oxford and start a new center there. Oh. So, like, well, Oxford, unemployment, I'll take Oxford. So moved to England, started the Center for Anthropology and Mind, it was called, where we were trying to bring cognitive science perspectives, thinking about how minds think, to study of anthropology and especially religion. And then we also started the Institute for Cognitive and Evolutionary Anthropology there at Oxford. Did that for 5 years, then was about time to start looking at possibilities in the States. My kids are getting older, knew they'd want to go to college in the United States. So had started sort of putting out feelers, and I guess people at Fuller must have caught wind of it because they were starting a new center there, the Thrive Center for Human Development, and they reached out to me, asked me if I would be the director of that. Wow. So that took me to Fuller, where I was for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And along the way, it seems as though there's been kind of one of these motivations is to kind of an integrative sort of like motivation, integrating various scientific disciplines, integrating theology and science as well. I guess, kind of how do you sort of, why do you see it as being important for Christians to do that kind of integrative work between the sciences and theology or psychology and, you know, theological studies?
Yeah, I think there's sort of two levels of integration at play here. One is a personal integration. Are you an integrated person? Mm. Are you really bringing all of yourself together into one piece? Is your faith motivating your vocation, how you think, and so forth? So I've always tried to be that kind of integrated person. Mm-hmm. And even when it's scary, kind of try to really take seriously, look, if I'm putting God and his kingdom first, I don't have to worry about the rest. Mm-hmm. So some people hearing what I just described would say, oh, you committed career suicide multiple times, which even leaving Cornell University with my doctorate and then starting to teach at Calvin College, I had people saying, what are you doing? Yeah. Our graduates don't teach at places like Calvin. Yeah. You're better than that. Yeah. Like, what are you talking about? Better than Calvin? Come on.
I'm a Calvin grad as well. So
you know what I'm saying then. Better stop. Just stop. But then there's that, you're right, this sort of, you might think disciplinary integration. And James, I think it's really important to think integratively because the world isn't carved up into disciplines. Mm. That's just not how the world works.
Right,
so if you want to make an impact in the real world on real problems, it's not carved at its joints by academic disciplines. Mm. That's an artificial kind of system that's in a historical anachronism in some ways, right? That's been imposed on the world. Mm. So we need to be really, I think, problem-oriented and think about, well, what are the right tools for this job, for this question? Mm. To make a difference here.
Yeah.
And odds are they're going to draw from a diversity of intellectual resources in order to have the biggest impact.
Yeah.
Now, that's the high-minded version of the answer. The low-minded version is, true confession, when I started as an academic, I didn't have two gifts that are really important for an academic, and that is the joy of reading and the joy of writing.
Mm.
I love to do scientific research. Mm. I like to gather the data. I like to crunch the numbers and stuff, but I didn't really much like writing. Mm. And I certainly didn't like reading. And the nice thing about finding these intersection points where, you know, it's not really owned by a particular discipline is there's just not a lot written there, so you don't have to read so much.
Just make it up as you go along.
Exactly.
That might be encouraging to some of our listeners who might be interested in academics. You don't have to read or write. That's just...
just find something new.
Just find something new.
I did say initially I didn't have that. And really, I mean, interestingly, because I really didn't feel like... I felt like that was... my weakness, and I had to sort of make do with my weakness. And I think partly that helped precipitate me leaving the academy, is I didn't feel like I had all the tools to do the job well. But for some reason, when I was a stay-at-home dad living in a farmhouse in rural Virginia, homeschooling my kids, I suddenly had the freedom to start writing my first book. Why I was writing a book, I don't know, other than it just seemed like a good thing to do.
Yeah.
And then I had the availability to do it. And I really do feel like God gave me the gift of enjoying writing. I could always write, but I never really enjoyed it. But suddenly I enjoyed it for the first time.
Wonderful.
And subsequently, I've also learned I'm actually kind of enjoy reading more than I used to. So he's given me the gifts that I think that I've needed at, you know, in time for what he's called me to be doing.
Wonderful. Well, on the subject of writing, you've just written this lovely book once again. If you need to see it, it's called Thriving with Stone Age Minds, Evolutionary Psychology, Christian Faith, and the Quest for Human Flourishing. Congratulations on writing it.
Thanks.
It's a lovely book. For those who might be listening who are unfamiliar with the book, maybe you could give a little bit of an introduction to it and what you were hoping to accomplish by writing it. Who were the main audiences that you had in mind, and what did you want them to learn?
Yeah.
My primary audience is really kind of, you know, clever, educated, advanced undergraduates who, maybe they're, studying psychology, maybe they're studying theology, maybe they think they're going to go into a ministry area, or maybe they're just generally educated people. But this sort of advanced undergraduate is my primary audience I had in mind. Maybe especially those who are coming with some kind of Christian background. Now, that's the majority of Americans are coming with some kind of a Christian background. And what I really wanted to do with the book initially was introduce Christians to this evolutionary psychology thing. What is evolutionary psychology? It's a controversial area in the academy, let alone among people of faith in the academy. There's even more controversial an area. But so I wanted to introduce it, but not in the usual kind of do an apologetic for, because I'm sympathetic to this is kind of an uncomfortable area. When people talk about evolutionary psychology, it's often about, I don't know, the selfishness of humans and how that's adaptive, or about our mating behaviors. And it starts sounding pretty sexist pretty quickly, or just sort of unwholesome in various ways, or just a little uncomfortable. And I don't want to ignore those features of evolutionary psychology, but that's not all of evolutionary psychology as I came to learn about it. Sort of accidentally through that very long and winding career pathway. So I wanted people to see it for what it was and to recognize that in it there were some resources that, in spite of its blemishes, that might be useful for some of these big theological kinds of questions. So I wanted to do a show, not tell. And the show is around this topic of thriving, as we termed it, or flourishing is another term that's used for this idea. When I started this project with Pam King and some of my colleagues in the Thrive Center at Fuller, well, thriving's in our title, so we wanted it to be about thriving. But partly Pam especially sold us on the term thriving instead of flourishing because she and her collaborators have written that thriving is not just about the individual's well-being or good life, but how the individual is in a reciprocal relationship with the communities around them, these sort of social rings that for me to be thriving, my family needs to be thriving. Right? I can't thrive at the expense of my family. And I don't have a thriving family if its members aren't thriving. My church needs to thrive with thriving members. It can't thrive unless your members are thriving. But likewise, thriving members of a church body need to be contributing to the church body, or they're not thriving, mm-hmm. right? There's something reciprocal at every stage. And that word thriving tries to remind us that we're not just talking about, I'm doing pretty well here, but that there's something reciprocal going on. So we used thriving as our case study for, can evolutionary psychology be something that, well, what is it? And can it be useful for theological inquiry?
Yeah. I mean, I have to confess that when I approached your book, I was one of those people who was a bit more skeptical about evolutionary psychology. My only exposure to it, however, was through Steven Pinker's work. And so I was like, oh, I don't know. So how would you approach somebody like me or a former version of myself? Now that I've heard your talk and read your book, it's, you know, I'm much more convinced, but I would love for other people to have the benefit of being convinced of its benefits. What's your sales pitch for the people who are like, eh, evolutionary psychology, I don't know about that. What would you say to somebody like that? And maybe you can tie it into thriving as well, because that's, you know, if it has payoff there, that would be really beneficial too.
I would probably ask the person who was concerned really to tell me more about what their concerns are.
Of course.
Because usually if there's an area of science or philosophy or theology that we feel uncomfortable with, there's a why behind it, and we want to figure out what that is, right? Mm-hmm. I named a couple of the reasons why I think it's common for people to be uncomfortable with. Mm-hmm. It's all focused on sex and reproduction. Well, it turns out it's not.
Right, right.
It's still all about sort of the individual success and or, you know, fitness. And like, well, no, actually, recent work in evolutionary psychology is much more likely to stress things like altruism, cooperation, how it is we get along with each other, because it looks like that's the kind of animal we are, is we actually, our fitness is dependent on the groups that we live in and sort of getting along with each other. And so then it starts, I suppose part of my pitch is, you know, this isn't your grandparents, you know, evolutionary psychology. This is sort of the new and improved version that has kind of outgrown sort of that awkward adolescent stage that was so fixated on sex. Yeah. It's moved on to things like, well, what does it mean to build strong communities? Why do we have the moral intuitions that we have? Why do our minds categorize and make sense of the world in the way that we do? Mm-hmm. And for people who are coming from a Christian perspective, you might see some really interesting points of resonance in evolutionary psychology that you wouldn't expect to find. Mm-hmm. Like, we read in Romans chapter 1, Paul talks about these sort of moral intuitions, you might say, that humanity just shares by virtue of being human. Mm-hmm. Well, evolutionary psychologists talk about that too.
Right.
We have in Christian theology this notion that that within all of us there's sort of the Reformed tradition calls it a sensus divinitatis. We hear about the God-shaped vacuum or this sort of yearning for the divine and so forth. Well, the cognitive science of religion, which is really informed by evolutionary psychology, says we've got evidence that, humans do have this sort of natural receptivity to the divine. Mm-hmm. It looks like that comes really easily or naturally to us. So there are more common touch points, I think, with evolutionary psychology than most believers realize.
I think that might be one of the objections or nervousnesses about an approach like this, is that it's going to somehow replace theology or replace the Bible or operate within a purely naturalistic kind of a framework. But it seemed to me, as I was reading the text, you were articulating evolutionary psychology as more of this sort of descriptive project. Here's kind of like how things have gone. But in order to get any traction on that, where that goes towards some kind of thriving, you need to have some kind of prescription from theology or philosophy as well. So it's not just a replacement kind of a theory, but I guess, do you see it more as another instance of this kind of integration, that you've got to do the descriptive and prescriptive work in order to get a full-fledged, or a fully orbed picture of what it is humans are supposed to be doing?
Yeah, I think that's a nice way to put it, is in many domains, the sciences are not terribly good at telling us what we ought to do. Mm-hmm. We need something else. We need a broader value system to tell us what we ought to do.
Sure, yeah.
In fact, this has been one of my irritations over the last year. We get all of these doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum they are on, but, you know, all these different politicians in different countries and places say, we're just following the science. Honestly, we do what the science says. It's all about the science. You're like, stop. Okay. You're, first of all, first of all, false. Second, impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not what science is. And I don't want a political leader who thinks that all they're doing is following the science, because they better be taking into account more than the science. We need values that orient us. The science describes, as you say, but we need something that prescribes or proscribes. So I think that's right. And it's also the case that I mean, I don't want to say there is no role for the sciences in informing those normative types of things beyond the just nuts and bolts of, okay, we've decided to do this. Here we go. How do we do that best? It's not technology in that sense, right? But it can help us see things like, well, what are the likely consequences of this course of actions? Does that help us reevaluate? Are we thinking clearly about, especially in the human sciences, say these particular feelings or way of thinking, have we carved up the space in the right way? But you're quite right. They don't tell us then on that basis what we should or ought to do about this. We need theology to fill that in. So it is an integration moment.
I think it makes me think of a quote that I heard from a scientist within the last year regarding COVID, who said, science can't tell you to love your neighbor. And the idea was that we need some external motivation in order to follow the things that are being said here. But that does particularly poignant. But your emphasis has been on thriving, which I find absolutely stimulating. And it has to do with our capacities as people with human natures and how those capacities match up to the worlds in which we live, or you have, you call them niches, right? And maybe could you unpack that a little bit and say, how is it that thriving is obtained in the life of a human community? What are the things that need to be in place? How do we respond to our environment? That kind of thing. I found that to be really, that's a lot, isn't it?
That's a lot. I tell you what, I'll start with what seem to be the challenges for us thriving, right? So suppose we've got a nice theological vision of thriving. So we know that we should be, you know, conformed to the image of Christ. We should be good stewards of the creation. We should love our neighbor and love God, right? These are things we should be doing. We should be manifesting the ninefold fruit of the Spirit. These are all theological concepts of what we should do. And I take it that a lot of us hope that that'll happen in our lives. We try to do that and, well, things happen and it doesn't go the way we hope. So what are those obstacles? What are those bumps that get in the way? Or what are the barriers for human thriving? And one of the things that we develop in the book is this notion of this friction between our nature and our niche, right? So that from an evolutionary perspective, we have become the animals we are in part of how, what's been successful, what have been successful strategies in dealing with these challenges in our ancestral past. And so who we are now is a product of what worked then. And then goes back maybe 200,000 years, maybe more. In some cases, certainly more. Some of the traits we have, we share with all kinds of other social animals, primates, and so forth. So we have this endowment that is from, you might think, a bygone age, at least for a lot of us in the world today. And so does that package of skills, of learning tendencies, of emotions, does it still work in today's society? And sometimes the answer is, well, not as well as we'd hope. I mean, maybe this is just my introversion talking, but cities are really scary places. We have reason to think that most of human evolutionary history was living in groups probably no bigger than about 150 people, occasionally pushing up to 300, maybe 500. But that's most of humanity's existence. In fact, it's only within the last 10 years that a majority of the world has been urbanized. Okay, that the majority of people now live in urban centers. That's only in recent history. But urban centers add tremendous amount of pressure on us socially. Mm. Our population density is much greater. The noise level is much greater. Mm-hmm. Density of pollutants is higher. All of these things that are actually not good for us. So there are some reports, World Health Organization, I believe, released a report recently suggesting that noise pollution is becoming a major cause of stressors. We know anxiety and stress-related kinds of psychological conditions are really on the rise, and they put their finger on noise. Mm. And we're talking about just cars. Mm-hmm. As well as the planes and helicopters and things like that that we see in urban centers, that it's we're constantly bombarded, which means we're physiologically aroused all the time at levels that our physiology isn't accustomed to accommodating. We can we're pretty flexible animals. We can accommodate a lot, but it weighs on us. Interacting with lots of strangers all the time, well, that's not a natural condition for humans. Mm. Most of our ancestral history, we would have run into people that we recognize. Mm. In fact, we'd almost never see strangers. Mm-hmm. If we did, everybody would know about it and we'd all be talking about it. We'd figure these people out as quickly as possible because strangers are threats. Mm-hmm. Well, now we interact with strangers in urban centers all the time. Okay. And so what do we learn to do? Ignore other people. Mm-hmm. So imagine that. Mm-hmm. Does that sound like what we're called to do from a Christian perspective is to ignore your neighbor as yourself, right? I mean, but that's what we've learned to do. And that's what this kind of social pressure has done to us.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, you got to do that because you can't walk down the street in downtown Chicago and intimately care for every single individual you're walking by. That seems overwhelming.
It's absolutely overwhelming and exhausting.
Like Buddy, an elf.
It is a little bit like Buddy and Elf. That's right. But each time you do that, what are you doing I don't want to sound too grandiose, but it's almost like little tears in your soul that you are ignoring your fellow human
being.
Out of necessity. So we've constructed these niches that not only from an evolutionary perspective don't quite fit our nature, but from a theological perspective seem to, damage our nature, seem to sort of tamp it down and sell us short. And so no, am I a big fan of cities? No. And I actually think they're not good for us. I think there are a lot of data that show that, you get higher violent crime, you get all kinds of social ills associated with big city living. And so, of course, I've come to Chicago to tell you this because that's just being a good guest. But
it seems like that is one of the points I got from the book is that physiologically or what have you, in terms of our Stone Age minds, they're at a certain point, but our use of technology, and we can say technology in a very broad sense from the car or, to the tablet and the cell phone and what have, has just ramped up exponentially. This is the social dilemma picture there, where now we're getting all these endorphin shots every couple of seconds because people are hitting our inboxes or they're hitting our likes or something like that. And we just can't handle that or it's just, it's too much for us to take even on a very visceral bodily level. So I guess my question is what do we do with that? do we pump the brakes on modern life in order to let our minds catch up with things? Do we think, we've orchestrated our niche in a way that is not quite healthy anymore. And so we've got to reorganize things in a way that more lines up with some of our present natural endowments.
Yeah, no, this is the big question. And in some ways, the book is an invitation to others to sort of start thinking along these lines. Because once we recognize that these are the challenges we're facing, then we've got motivation to then try to address those challenges. Mm-hmm. I suspect, look, there's no going back. Mm-hmm. We can't suddenly go all primitivist on this. Mm-hmm. And we are a flexible, adaptive species that manages to culturally scaffold all kinds of wonderful, good things. Mm. Not everything that is sort of stretching our nature is a bad thing.
Yeah.
In fact, our nature seems to be that we fiddle with our niche. Mm. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is part of us being, some theologians talk about us being co-creators with God. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to say it's all bad. But what's it centered on, maybe, is where we go. Is it playing to the values, the priorities that are at the core, at the heart of a thriving life, loving God, mm-hmm. loving other people, manifesting these various fruits, conforming to the image of Christ. Have we organized our cultural systems around that? Mm. Well, no, obviously not. Mm. Instead, what are we doing? We're sort of super stimulating, our hedonistic centers, right?
Yeah.
Making ourselves feel certain things bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm. You talked about sort of those endorphin or, different kinds of chemical rushes we get from our cell phones,
yeah.
heck, from sugary foods,
sure.
right? There's another one of those things mm-hmm. where, from an evolutionary perspective, it's commonly said that we, the reason we're so attracted to sugary, fatty kinds of things is because these were hard to get. Sweet things indicative of like things that high in vitamins, like berries and stuff like that. Hard to get, temporary, so you better eat as many as you can fast. So you need motivations. Mm-hmm. Fatty foods usually would come from animal fats, which are really important, it turns out, sorry, vegans, for building good brains.
Mm-hmm.
It's even thought that actually that shift to eating lots of meat and cooking animals has helped build our brains.
Mm-hmm.
But we're attracted then to fats because they were hard to come by, relatively rare and very nutrient dense, as well as these sugary things. Put them together in a donut and it's like magic. But then that's a substitute for the genuine article that we get hooked on.
Yeah.
And we're drug addicts at a certain point, and it starts eroding our thriving, in this case, our bodily health, just because it's mimicking the right input conditions
sort
of in a super stimulant kind of way. So can we pair some of those back, and can we start thinking about how do we reconstruct our priorities around thriving priorities instead of what makes us feel good
mm-hmm.
or what'll generate lots of money or whatever those other priorities are.
Mm.
Maybe in some cases that will mean taking a big step backwards and saying, you know what? Mega cities is not the way forward. Let's not do this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing that maybe if there's a good thing of COVID, it did start waking people up to that maybe actually when things fall apart, you don't want to be in major urban centers because there are too many people, or it's a pressure cooker. So lots of people have fled from the cities, which reversed a major trend that had been going on for decades, right, of everybody flooding to the cities.
Yeah.
So maybe there are some minor steps backwards, but I have a feeling it more has to do with, can we reorient, reprioritize around thriving principles?
Well, and I appreciate that invitation. The book does seem to be kind of an invitation to start some thinking about this. How do we sort of like integrate our theological values with our scientific observations in a way that leads us to some kind of end that might be productive for our human following of Christ and our human relationships as well.
Mm-hmm.
We'll need to talk about that more on some other time, because that's just the foreword. I've got a number of people to thank for the end of this episode. First, I want to thank Dr. Barrett for being here with us. I really appreciate this conversation. Grateful also to my co-host, Felipe. We're grateful to our producer, Curtis, for making us look and sound good, and our graduate assistant, Lauren Januzik. Also want to thank the organizations that have helped this conversation come about. So myself, Dr. Steve Grego, and Dr. Jeffrey Fulkerson in the Henry Center all collaborated on a grant through the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, their Dozier Project, the Dialogue on Science and Religion. It's an initiative on science for the seminary. So they gave us some funding to have some conversations about how do we integrate science into the seminary curriculum. Dr. Barrett's here as part of that grant. He gave a talk earlier today, leading workshops with our faculty as well, and just trying to like create some more synergy around having hard and challenging and really enriching conversations here among the faculty, among the students too, on how we can think about science and theology and religion. So we're grateful for that funding as well. And most of all, we're thankful to you, our listeners. I'm James Arcati.
I'm Felipe Deauville. Thanks for listening and watching.
Forward is a podcast hosted by faculty at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. The views expressed by the hosts and guests of Forward do not necessarily represent the views of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. You can subscribe to our newest episode on your preferred podcast app or at forwardpodcast.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Forward Podcast to get updates and additional links to content. Trinity Evangelical Divinity School is located 25 miles north of Chicago with extension sites across the country and online. Trinity educates men and women to engage in God's redemptive work in the world by cultivating academic excellence, Christian faithfulness, and lifelong learning. You can find more information at teds.edu.